WAUK Jackson, Milwaukee's real news and great conversation. A Civic Media station.
CBS News Brief. Patience is the key word tonight as millions of people head for their Thanksgiving destinations. Luke Pretzi is driving to Chicago.
Take deep breaths, count to 10, try not to get upset by the way other people are driving around you. It's worked for me so far.
Rain and snow is hampering travel in parts of the Midwest and Northeast. New York City Mayor Eric Adams promises tight security for the Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade tomorrow.
Uniformed personnel, some of them you're going to see, some of them you're not going to see. We know how to do this right.
In its first statement since the ceasefire with Israel took effect, Hezbollah claims it has achieved victory over Israel. The BBC's Hugo Bashega.
They said they don't think they've been defeated despite the huge blows that Hezbollah has suffered. Weeks of intense Israeli airstrikes. The group's infrastructure has been heavily damaged. The group's leadership has been practically decimated.
Thousands of southern Lebanese residents have returned to their homes. CBS News Brief. I'm Michael Wallace.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
The Bucks are back to 500. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Bucks with a 106-103 win over the Heat in Miami. Milwaukee's win-loss record now even at 9-9. Just before the tip-off, Giannis Antetokounmpo had his left knee flare up with swelling and was unable to play. How did that change the game plan? Head coach Doc Rivers.
When Giannis went out, it was such a late scratch. You know, kind of had a scrambling. We usually go with bigs, and we decided to play small ball the entire game because I really felt like with so much scoring, the only way we're going to win the game is we have to win a three-point game.
NFL, the Packers getting ready for their Thursday night game on NBC for Thanksgiving. I asked Jordan Love how he feels about playing in prime time on the holiday.
Yeah, it's awesome. You know, anytime you're prime time, especially playing on a day like Thanksgiving where, you know, I grew up eating Thanksgiving food and watching football. So, you know, a lot of people, that's kind of the tradition. So it's definitely special. You know, we love these primetime games for sure.
That's quarterback Jordan Love. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
The Todd Alba Show.
Trevi Olson, senior advisor at the Lincoln Project.
We as individuals need to be far better in terms of getting the tools we need to have the conversations. You're never going to shame someone out of their political beliefs.
Yes.
You're never going to get them with talking points.
You nailed it. And I think that that's what some of our friends on the left don't get. And I think it's destructive and it's not beneficial.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Real news, great conversation from Milwaukee and beyond. 540 WAUK.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to. Lots to talk about. What a shared experience I had today. One of those moments that if you've experienced it, and I have never felt this before. But since my wife's accident, you know, I've taken on some roles that I have not done before. My wife and I led a very traditional, you know, kind of, we had to leave it to Beaver existence. My wife stayed home, took care of the children, took care of the house, did everything there. I worked, took care of things when things broke, the cars. Very, very traditional kind of separation of labor, division of labor, being what we would have considered a very traditional situation. So now that my wife is in the hospital and has been there since September 12th, I've had to take on the role of Mr. Mom. And I'm not doing really well. I'm trying. I'm putting all my energy into it. I'm catching up. The kids say I'm doing okay. So that's kind of what's important. But I went to the grocery store, and this is one of those things where I haven't been to this grocery store in probably like 5 years. You know, whenever I need to pick something up from the store, I go to one of the smaller ones. There's a small local chain that has it's the one I usually go to. You know, it's got everything you need. Not a lot of choices. You get what you need. And that's where I go. You're in, you're out, zip. I spend 20, 30, 50 bucks. That's where I go. When my wife does the big shopping, you know, the $300, $400, know, she goes to the big grocery store. Well, I had to go to that one. It's, like I said, the first time in probably more than 5 years that I've been in there. And evidently, you know, when you go to the deli counter now, there's no more little tab to pull. I'm used to going to the counter, you pull the little number, you got your number. You stand there, you wait for the little thing in the back to have your number. You go, hey, I got my number. Here's what I want. You talk to someone. That someone says, hey, well, how do you want it sliced? What, how much do you want? How much? All that. We've all been there, right? That's not how this works. So everything is now done through a kiosk. You have to go and, you know, type in what you want. You type in your phone number and they tell you when it's done. I guess it's more efficient. I guess, you know, it maybe it saves somebody some time. I don't know. But I did this and I, you know, the woman pointed me in the direction saying, we don't talk to anyone anymore. So I did this and I left. My phone, you know, chimes and I go, oh, okay, I guess it's done. I head back there. I have nowhere idea where to pick it up. No idea whatsoever. I'm looking around. There's no one to talk to because you don't see any of the workers anywhere anymore. They have a robot that rides around, but I refuse to talk to that because I feel dumb. And this may just be being an old guy. You know, hey, I like it the way it used to be. I may be a little resistant to change. I don't know. But I liked it better when there were workers there who were making a living, you know, usually a reasonable living, someone who took pride in the work that they did and say, oh, we're going to get you exactly what you want. Or, hey, if you don't know, maybe I'm going to help you because I didn't know what I was getting. I'm getting ham. I don't know the difference really between the tavern, the Black Forest, the Virginia, the, you know, the maple, whatever. So, I get it on the kiosk. I get that. I come back and I can't find it. So I'm just standing there. I'm like there like 3 minutes and I have this feeling just come over me. And the strangest feeling I've had of, I don't know what I'm doing. I go, what the heck am I doing? And a woman finally, a customer comes over and goes, you need help? And I said, I can't find the ham. So she walks me over to this little box that I would have never found in a million years with like 20 font type on it that said deli pickup. And there was my order with the little number. And I got it. And it made me start to think about the brave new world in which we're entering, where technology's great. Technology has made the world smaller. We're closer. I can, you know, on a global scale, we're closer than we've ever been. But, you know, the people next door seem to be much further away. I can pick up my phone and talk to an economist in Zimbabwe, but I can't get the deli counter to get me a slice of ham. And it's almost like this kind of technology is self-defeating, where you get both what you want, you know, the convenience and the connectivity, but what you don't want, which is, you know, massive walls of separation and new processes. And there's part of me that goes, you know, this is where we're heading. And, you know, interestingly enough, you know, I look at where we are. And this last election was very much about anger. This was an anger election. And I feel that tension with people. You know, in the supermarket, you talk to people. No one, you try and talk to people. Nobody will speak to you. It's, I got a business and I gotta go check myself out. That communal aspect is gone. And look, I look at the world we're in where I get it. People are working harder and longer for less. They're afraid that what the future brings because we don't have the safety net of past generations. We've been told that, you know, we have to have the most toys and all of this stuff. And life is getting a little more difficult. I get that. And it's just today that feeling kind of just came over me. In the moment, and I get what I get why people are angry. I understand that the change is difficult. I'm not thrilled with a lot of stuff, and I hope we stop some of it. But it made me think that the best way forward, and this is what I was thinking as I was standing there, the best way forward is to talk to each other, to communicate. And whether it's, you know, the technology that does that for us, or we just knock on a neighbor's door, or in this situation, this woman who came up to me and said, are you okay? can I help you? And the answer was, yeah. You know, I didn't know where the ham was. And mock me if you will, and you can, because I probably deserve it. But I think a lot of people feel that way. I think we're in a moment where things are changing so rapidly that it's a struggle. But I want to hear your thoughts. What do you think? Have you shared my experience? I want to hear it. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, Matt Gaertz from Media Matters is going to be here to share some thoughts on the Trump appointments and, well, the circus that's become. Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I gotta tell you, I love this statement that Trump made over on Fox News, saying that, you know, if we're gonna make America great, it's vital that we have, how did he put it, free, fair, and open media, and that he is committed and says he has an obligation to the American people to work with the press, even those who have treated him, how do you put it, badly beyond comparison or comprehension. I look at this and I go, aren't you the guy who's suing most of the media companies who have been critical of you? Never mind. Don't look behind the curtain. But here to answer the question I asked yesterday, will our media step up in this moment? Will they do the vetting of Trump's nominees that clearly they're never going to do? And that's why I've asked Matt Gaertz to come talk with us. Matt's a senior fellow over at Media Matters, mediamatters.org, the website. Matt, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's start with the Trump comment on a free, fair, and open media. Are we buying any of this rhetoric? Are we seeing that coming out of Trump now? Is there a new leaf been turned over that I've missed?
Oh, no. All this is the same old from Donald Trump. His version of a free and fair media is one that is constantly praising him and attacking all of his enemies. He's been very clear about that for years and years now. Even Fox News is often not quite enough for him. You know, he's complained over the last several months anytime they've had any Democrats on the air or Fox contributors who are more on the left side or even commercials for Democratic candidates. He wants to see from media outlets nothing but pure praise for him and all of his accomplishments, and anything else he's gonna complain about. And at this point, maybe start using the power of the federal government to put them into line.
And by put them into line, you know, I've been saying to my audience, if tomorrow I'm missing, it's not because I wanted to. And if you heard I fell out of a window, that didn't happen. Even if it's a big window, that didn't happen. Because there's the talk of retribution. There's the talk of punishment. And you go, how far can that go? I honestly, you know, if you'd asked me 10 years ago, the Putin-esque kind of stuff could never happen here. I don't know.
I don't know if the Putin-esque stuff could happen, but the Orban-esque stuff I definitely think could happen. Viktor Orban, the Hungarian autocrat in that country, who has spent the last several years wielding various state powers to force media outlets to be sold to his cronies. That's something that Donald Trump very much could do, and indeed, to some extent, tried to do in his first term.
So more Elon Musk buying up, you know, things like Twitter, and then, you know, like a good businessman taking it from a value of $44 billion down to now. It's about $10 billion is what they're assessing the value somewhere there. That's how you run a business.
Yeah, or, you know, Rupert Murdoch trying to buy CNN when its parent company was trying to merge with another company, and Donald Trump's Justice Department had cracked down on it. You know, there are all sorts of different levers that an autocratic administration could try to use in order to force media outlets to obey. And he's shown his willingness to use them in the past, and I think we're going to see more of them in the future.
Yeah, the free, fair, and open, as long as it's appraising me, that should have been the rest of the sentence. But I do got to get your thoughts on, you know, there's talk of, for the first time, at least in my lifetime, you've got a presidential, you know, coming in, bringing his cabinet people in, who are saying, you know what, we're going to privatize the background checks. You know, we don't need the FBI. We're not going that route. I think this is where media has to really then step in and fill the void that is going to be left, because it's interesting that, you know, we found little things so far, but, you know, how much more is out there on some of these guys?
I think it's hard to say, and that's the danger of not having the FBI background checks, is that the FBI gets access to all sorts of classified intelligence files for putting those background checks together. And, you know, for people like Matt Gaetz or Tulsi Gabbard, I think there are questions about what sort of influence different foreign governments could have on them. And it'll be much more difficult for journalists to get to the bottom of that. I'm sure some of them at least will try. I think we could see, you know, as I was talking earlier, various corporate bosses trying to knuckle under to Donald Trump and throwing reporters off the scent. But, you know, there's going to be a vast array of information that is just not going to be easily accessible to them in the same way it would have been to the FBI, which I assume is the reason why they're forgoing the background checks in the first place. They know that what they're going to find is not very good, and they want to make sure that they have plausible deniability about all of it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the first one that comes up is this Hegseth guy who evidently, you know, someone found that, you know, he paid someone that, you know, whatever, however you want to put this, he paid someone, he claims consensual, she says no, he paid someone, there seems to be a theme there that that ties him and Trump together, never mind the fact that she was married and the family values people, never mind any of that, but if you don't find that in your privatized background check before you throw somebody out there, it either tells me, one, you're doing a poor job, or you wanted it out there, because it is the distraction. It's the salacious stuff that will get people off the scent. So as you pointed out, the people who have really, really serious problems and things to hide, maybe they slip through.
Yes, though what I do think that something like that points to is that Hegseth is very vulnerable to blackmail. I mean, this is someone who seems to have a long record of, at the very least, womanizing in ways that he wouldn't want made public. You know, the thing that everyone agrees on with this particular case is that immediately after he divorced his second wife and after his executive producer at Fox had his child, but before he married said executive producer, that is when this sexual encounter took place. So that's the thing that everyone agrees on. But yeah, I think that is the sort of thing that points to more vulnerabilities that someone could have to blackmail. And that's the sort of thing that traditionally you'd want the FBI to kind of sort out.
Yeah, you know, because how many more are out there? If you know, this is someone who clearly a very low moral compass, And those, I believe those are the people who are much more susceptible to blackmail and being put in the, and putting themselves in that situation. So I wouldn't be surprised what else comes out, which is crazy. So in looking at this circus, Matt, because we've, it's kind of been a circus when your attorney general pick is someone like Matt Gaetz, I think you want that circus environment, or at least I think they want it. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think this is what happens when you use Fox News as your staffing agency. I mean, we're already at five different people that Trump has picked for high-ranking positions that previously had Fox News on their resume. And so that's Hegseth and Gabbard and Huckabee and Mike Waltz and someone else who I'm forgetting, Tom Homan, the so-called border czar. And in addition to those, you've got a bunch of other people that he has nominated for different positions that have a lot of Fox News appearances to their name. So people who Donald Trump has seen on his television saying nice things about him for years and years, very much including Matt Gaetz. And when that is the credential that you're using to assess whether someone is a good fit for a high-ranking government position, you're going to have trouble, because the reason people get on Fox News is to say nice things about Donald Trump and say crazy things that the network's audience likes. That is not what makes, I think, a good high-ranking White House or administration official, but that's what Trump's going with.
Yeah, and the Gaetz thing to me was, I'm going, you know, it seems the ultimate troll. And I get, you know, Gaetz has been, you know, a true believer, well, you know, a sycophant. I get all that, but there's no way he gets confirmed, which means a recess appointment perhaps. But, you know, even then you go, you're just making a mockery of the Justice Department, which then I sit back and I go, well, that's kind of the point, isn't it?
I don't know how convinced I am that any of these nominees are going to get blocked. I mean, I think one of the strategic virtues of putting a bunch of different crazy people up for major jobs is that Republican senators are going to try to pick their spots. And some of them are going to say, okay, I'm drawing the line at Matt Gaetz. And some of them are going to say, I'm drawing the line at RFK Jr. And some of them are going to say, I'm drawing the line at Tulsi Gabbard. And if they're all picking different lines, then some of these people are going to squeak through. Because I don't know if Republican senators are going to want to try to block four or five nominees each. That is, you know, at a time when the Republican base is really angry and willing to engage in violent threats against sitting members of Congress, I don't know if they're going to do that.
No, it's an interesting point, but you know, the more my thinking is, and you can agree or disagree, and I'd like to get your thoughts, is that by putting some of these comical kind of circus characters into these positions, the people who I think are really dangerous, the CEO types, the people who want to privatize, profitize, and destroy our government from within, they're going to slide through like a hot knife through butter. And we aren't even going to know who they are, because like a cat chasing the laser pointer, we're focused on Matt Gaetz.
So I'm of two minds about this. I think you're right that a lot of the economic policy, important positions are going to get short shrift. And I think they're likely to use those. They're going to fill those positions with fat cats and bankers and people who will use government to hurt the working class of this country. At the same time, I don't think that we can discount the kind of damage that someone like Matt Gaetz can do at the Department of Justice. You know, as someone who is so purely loyal to Donald Trump, and given Donald Trump's own, repeated pattern of demanding federal criminal investigations of his various political enemies, someone like Matt Gaetz is not going to try to foist those off like Jeff Sessions did during Trump's first term. Right. He's going to try to pursue them all the way. And that gets us in very dangerous territory with the rule of law.
So who's the scariest of the, in your view, of the nominees so far? Is it Kristi Noem, there at Homeland Security and shoots her dog? Or who are you watching most closely if it's not Gates?
I think it's probably Kennedy. And the reason for that is he's occupying a segment of government that Trump is totally uninterested in. He could not care less about. He is going to spend absolutely no time reining in anything that Kennedy wants to do. And at the same time, Kennedy's going to have control over the largest share of domestic spending. He's going to have a huge amount of oversight over Medicaid and Medicare, in addition to agriculture policy and drug policy. You can do a lot of damage with those agencies. And without anyone really trying to restrain him, I think things could get out of control very quickly.
No, but with him, there's a couple of things I do actually agree with. I think you do have to take on Big Pharma at some point. I just don't know what the kind of zealotry that he's talking about, or the kind of kookery. I mean, I go back to 2002 when my oldest daughter was born. He scared the hell out of me and a lot of parents with the whole Tamiflu that's in the vaccine causes autism, and all your children are going to be autistic because of these vaccines. It's that kind of hair on fire kind of policymaking that kind of worries me in this position. I think much to your point.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're exactly right. I think there's a lot to complain about with the status quo around both pharma and big ag. The problem is that someone like RFK Jr. is going to be, because of the kookery that you mentioned, shooting at the wrong targets. And more likely to destroy the things that are good about the system than the parts that are bad.
And that's why what I've been saying is watch where the lobby money goes. Watch where Big Pharma spends their money. If they go after him with a full-throated attack to not get him confirmed, then, maybe they're not thrilled. But if they don't really make a peep, be afraid. Be very afraid. Just my thoughts. Lastly, got to get your thoughts on the efficiency, the Department of Government efficiency that now will have two people at the head of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're going to run into problems with this one very quickly, because most of the sort of ideas about increasing government efficiency actually cost more money, not less. And most of the ideas for very quickly and painlessly reducing government spending end up being total nonsense vaporware. These are, I just don't see this going anywhere. I kind of think that for the most part, this is going to end up being a way that Trump, sort of took some people that could meddle around and just kind of put them out on an island. I don't know what kind of actual power they're going to have over there.
I don't either, but it will be interesting to see when Musk realizes that you're right and he doesn't have any power and that nobody's listening to him, if he turns on Trump, because it could be, it's going to be who throws who under the bus first is where my interest level in this is.
Yeah, I think that is the circus, though, right? That is the thing where the stakes are probably not that high because they probably aren't going to be able to get much done. But the food fight will be fun to watch, at least.
But, when you listen to what Musk has said in the past, this idea of cutting 30% of government spending, and you said the word painlessly, being more efficient and cutting painlessly, that's nobody's interest over there. I argue the pain is the point. And the solutions that we're going to have going forward, that's going to come out of the savagery of what they actually do get through, like completing the privatization of Medicare, of cutting Medicaid, of going after food stamps, which they're going to do. It's going to be that pain that they inflict, where I think all of us who are affected by it had better wake up to the reality that they came for us.
The biggest legislative fight of the next year is going to be over extending and expanding the Trump tax cuts from his first term. That is something in the realm of like $4.5 billion of tax cuts over 10 years. And if they want to fill any part of that
trillion,
trillion, $4.5 trillion over 10 years. If they're going to try to do that in a budget neutral way, a deficit neutral way, they're going to need to come up with a huge amount of spending cuts. And that means Medicaid, that means Medicare, that means Social Security back on the table. There's no other way to do it. And, you know, the numbers don't add up otherwise.
Yep. I'm right there with you, Matt. Matt Kurtz, I appreciate the time. Great talk with you. I'm sure we will be talking a lot over the next at least year, most likely four, but I appreciate the time.
Sounds great.
Thanks so much, Matt Kurtz, senior fellow there at Media Matters. I want to hear your thoughts. Do you think, as he said, do you think it's Medicare? Do you think it's Medicaid? Do you think it's Social Security? You think those are the chopping block? Or are you one of the naive ones who say, no, no, he wouldn't do that? Just like, no, no, Project 2025 isn't his baby. I want to hear it. Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Right back.
Your new choice. Real news. Great conversation. 540 WAUK.
This is your hometown radio. Refreshed. Keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Mostly cloudy for tonight, a low in the upper 20s. A mixture of sunshine and clouds for tomorrow, a high to the mid-30s. Couple of flurries tomorrow night, then some sunshine returns Friday. Cold, though, and breezy, high only upper 20s.
It's 28 degrees right now.
The Dom Salvia Show.
Harvey Kay, Professor Emeritus of Democracy at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. Harvey, I know you're the big FDR expert.
1934, he decided that the inequality and the wealth accumulated at the top was a threat not only to the American economy, but also to the American democratic spirit, American democratic life.
Sounds like history's repeating itself.
The Dom Salvia Show. Weekdays from 4 till 6 on the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Civic Media app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
The sad reality, as we've been talking about, is come January 20th, we're going to find out what a business administration looks like. For all those people saying, yo, I like President Trump because he's a businessman. He's going to bring business values. Well, I think we're going to find out because this administration is being taken over by the CEOs, by the executives, by the, well, the bean counters. And what's that going to mean for working people? What happens when you put a corporate chieftain at the head of the National Labor Relations Board? What happens when you put one of our captains of industry in charge of the Department of Labor, OSHA? Any of those things, well, that help protect workers across the country. And here to share some thoughts on that, I've asked my good friend Jordan Barab to come talk with us. Jordan was a former acting assistant secretary and deputy assistant secretary of labor for OSHA during the Obama years, and my go-to guy for all things danger in the workplace. And you might want to check out his blog, jordanbarab.com/confined space. Jordan, thanks for taking time for us.
Happy to be here, Rick.
So do you agree we're going to see what business government looks like as the CEOs are taking over?
Yeah, definitely. Of course, you know, we don't know who's going to take over yet, the Department of Labor or certainly OSHA. But we know, given his other nominees, it's not going to be good. We're trying to figure out what's going to happen. And we have, you know, past Republican administrations to go on. We have Trump's first term to look at. As we've been seeing from some of his other appointments, we ain't seen nothing yet.
No, and that's the reality. These seem to be even more extreme than the last. And it's, for me, it's part of the circus, I think, that we're going to see over the next year or two, because I think it's going to be all about bread and circus. They're going to feed us crazy while in the back rooms, the really ugly stuff, we're not going to get to see or pay attention to because we're too busy watching the cat laser.
Yeah. We'll see. I mean, yeah, there's some obvious things they may do, but it's gonna be hard because they're gonna both do things that are gonna end up in the headlines, and things that nobody's gonna see that are gonna do damage as well.
Yeah, I mean, like during the first term, they had the head of MSHA was a mine executive, right? I mean, so
right.
You know, for me, I'm like, well, you know, Amazon, I know, is one of the worst, employers in the warehouse industry for injuries to workers in the workplace. Maybe an Amazon executive will be the head of OSHA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or a Department of Labor. Yeah, we don't really know. I mean, it's not, you know, unusual for, you know, Republicans to appoint bad people to head both Department of Labor and OSHA. Of course, you know, Trump's first term, there was never anybody confirmed to head OSHA. I mean, it was, you know, he nominated someone who was having problems, and, you know, nobody paid enough attention or cared enough about the agency to actually make sure there was somebody heading it. So, you know, one hopes OSHA is so small, you know, which we complain about it being so small, but it's so small that, you know, they hardly notice, although I don't have too much hope in that, given who's going to be running the government and Elon Musk with his Department of Government Efficiency.
Yeah, him and the other guy, two guys to do the one job.
Yeah.
You know, that's highly efficient. But, you know, the point for me is, and as you pointed out, they didn't have anybody running it. And I argue because nobody thought that he was going to win the first time around. So a lot of this stuff went without notice. Right now, you know, we go back to Project 2025, which we've talked about in this show extensively. The entire right wing cesspool of think tanks, they've been gaming out and plotting and planning what they're going to do in this first year. So yeah. I guarantee, and maybe you'll agree or you won't, but I guarantee OSHA did not go unnoticed by them.
Yeah, OSHA wasn't mentioned a whole lot in Project 2025, that, you know, which is good. Although there was, you know, it was mentioned somewhat, and obviously OSHA will be affected by, you know, the broader measures that the Trump takes, like Schedule F, you know, and trying to get rid of much of the, you know, what's now career civil service. That will hit every agency badly. You know, his other general, you know, policies about, you know, favoring small businesses, that's always been a major criticism of OSHA, you know, that OSHA should exempt small businesses from enforcement and things like that. So, you know, we're sure to see that kind of traditional Republican attitudes in terms of, you know, shrinking the agency. You know, no Republicans ever do any new standards or anything like that. You know, we'll just see what else they come up with beyond what the usual Republican strategy is for OSHA.
Now, let me ask you this, because you've just said the most important thing. There will be no new standards coming out during the Trump years. There will be no advancement on protecting people in heat or in weather or any of the things that we have to deal with. Did the Biden administration do enough to protect us moving forward? Did they get the heat standard through? Did we move on something that might not be undone right away? Is there any hope in this for you?
No. you know, unfortunately, and I've criticized them for this. Unfortunately, the Biden administration was counting on two terms. So they worked on a whole bunch of different standards. They didn't finalize any of them, figuring, you know, if they got them kind of all up to almost the finish gate, they could finalize them in the second administration or the second term. And obviously there's not going to be a second term. So, you know, what we've had here is 4 years where the Biden administration has issued no major standards, you know. And this has been a problem. I mean, when we were there, we were trying to get out, you know, as they say, there's a kind of difference between footprints in the sand and footprints in cement. Standards are footprints in cement. They're very hard to get rid of once they're issued. But, you know, all the work that's gone into all these, including all the work that's gone into heat, you know, we'll see what happens. You know, I would be very doubtful whether this administration moves forward on the heat standard. They may just try to get rid of it, although that's a little harder, or they may just let it sit and kind of molder for 4 years. We'll see what happens. But no, we don't expect these guys to be issuing any new standards. Yeah, and pretty much all the work the Biden administration has done will either go down the drain or just lie dormant for the next 4 years.
Yeah, no, but for me, you know, we hear this mantra of job-killing regulation, and we're going to hear this for the next couple of years, especially as, you know, this deregulation push happens, because, you know, the CEO class, they spent a lot of money to get Trump put back in there, and there's been a lot of expectations. They want their return on investment, and that is, you know, less safe workplaces. That is lower wages for workers. That is, you know, destroying overtime in this country. Mm-hmm. You know, all of the stuff that, you know, we fought for in the 20th century, I fear is on the chopping block here in 2025.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you've got, you know, Elon Musk in there who, you know, whose companies have been what he would call the victim of government regulation. I mean, there's, you know, he's got both in Tesla and SpaceX, you know, numerous health and workplace health and safety issues. You know, he's trying to basically declare, have the National Labor Relations Act declared unconstitutional. So he's got all these people. And you know, you look at all the CEOs who are delighted about Trump's election, you know, they've got two priorities, tax cuts and deregulation. Yeah. And obviously, that's going to filter down into OSHA and all of the labor protection agencies as well.
No. As a fellow labor guy, I mean, is this not a moment where, you know, we, the voting populace, has to decide which side are we on, the age-old question? Because I've been saying, look, you know, the CEOs are going to run this country like they've dreamt of. They are going to whip out their wet dream list, and they're going to be able to get a lot of things that they want. And I believe that's going to harm a lot of us. So, you know, while it may be horrible, and I've been saying the solutions are going to be in their savagery, you know, could this possibly be something that when we look back goes, yeah, maybe we needed this to shake people awake?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, because I think, you know, obviously with the Republicans controlling the White House and both houses of Congress and the Supreme Court, the only, you know, real progress that's going to be made in the next few years is going to be on the local level. And, you know, hopefully that means also in terms of the local union level, in terms of, you know, more organizing in general, and also more organizing about specific issues such as workplace safety and health.
Now, you know, because I'll tell you, you know, OSHA's been around since 1970, as you obviously know, and I think our listeners and viewers know. It has done a very good job of creating safer workplaces, not entirely safe, but much safer than when my grandparents were working in the 50s and 60s. And there's part of me that goes, maybe we've done too well. Maybe we've protected people from the savages of what capitalism and our chieftains of industry bring us. And maybe this is going to be one of those moments where we get a small taste of how things used to be.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's been a criticism for a lot of, you know, labor, you know, legislation, that it's, you know, all these issues used to be fought for, you know, on the work floor, basically. Now the government's taking care of that. So unions, you know, become, you know, less concerned with those issues because government's taking care of it. And they're more focused on, you know, just wages and benefits. But obviously, there's going to have to be a reckoning now, because the federal government not only isn't going to be helpful, you know, they're going to be actively harmful to any kind of unionization efforts, organizing efforts, health and safety, child labor, all those issues that we've been hoping to make some progress on. And that, you know, especially in the Biden administration, has mostly been, you know, very, very helpful on, very active on, and, you know, really has been one of the most pro-union administrations that anybody has seen. But obviously, you know, now there's going to have to be some new strategies. And I think that's going to have to be more on the local level.
You know, and you brought up Elon Musk, and we never talk about Vivek Ramaswamy, who's his handmaiden. You know, I look at the things that they want to cut. They say there are 400 agencies. They want to cut them down to 99. This, I believe, OSHA and a lot of the EPA and a lot of things that protect us, I think, are things that are on the chopping block. What would things look like? I mean, understand, and we've talked about this before, the agency's so poorly funded, it would take like 140 years for the inspectors to inspect every workplace in the country. But if you wipe it out, well, they're never going to get inspected, no matter how many years. So I'm curious your thoughts. Is this one that you think is easy for Musk just to go check off the list?
Yeah, well, you know, it'll be interesting. I mean, you can't, you know, Republicans, although they've kind of wanted to, they've never been able to, you know, eliminate OSHA, because it's the law, right? I mean, there is a law passed in 1970 that creates the agency and the rights that workers have in the agency, in the agency, and the ability of OSHA to issue and enforce standards. And, you know, I doubt, assuming the filibuster survives, I doubt if they'll be able to, you know, have the votes to eliminate OSHA or eliminate EPA, for example. But, you know, there are rumors that you know, that they're just going to go around that. They're just going to eliminate agencies anyway, you know, and if they get sued, fine, it goes through the courts for 4 years. Even if there's a good judgment at the end, you know, we're several years down the road and everybody's gone.
No, and that's what I was going to mention. I'm going, it's kind of cute that you believe they care about the rule of law. I mean, it is kind of cute that, you know, you think a CEO cares when they control, you know, the White House, the House and the Senate. And oh, by the way, that Supreme Court that makes the ultimate decision, I think they believe they've got a fairly good hand. And I do believe that they are going to overreach in a huge way. And as I've said, the solutions will be in the savagery. So when they do what they want, we better be aware of what they're doing and make sure people know about it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's the challenge that we have here, because you know, the news is so split up that people, you know, aren't necessarily getting that information, which was what, you know, partly what I tried to do with Confined Space. I mean, I try to write about these things so that, you know, workers, union members, policymakers will understand kind of what's going on behind the scenes that isn't making the headlines. And I can pretty much guarantee you that, you know, barring some major disaster, most of what happens at OSHA is not going to be, you know, make the front pages of the New York Times or the Washington Post or any, or, you know, MSNBC or Fox, unless, you know, again, there's a major disaster.
Now, I check your writing at least weekly, and I hope folks will check it out as well. JordanBarab.com/confined space. We'll get links out on social media because I think this is an important site for working people to go and see what's really going on, because we never hear about this. Generally, our news media is, if it bleeds, it leads, unless it's a worker involved.
Mm. Or usually a bunch of workers involved. You know, they don't really care about one or two workers getting killed. You know, the only time any kind of health and workplace health and safety issue makes the front pages is if you have 10 or 15 people killed during the same incident. Otherwise, nobody cares that much, quite frankly.
Yeah. So let me ask you a last line of questioning, because, you know, clearly, you know, the attacks are going to come. Clearly, we know that there will be someone who wants to restrain, restrict, deregulate, destroy not just OSHA, but a lot of agencies. You know, as working people, you know, what would your suggestion be as union leaders across the country? What would you suggest to them? What's the action? What's the motivation in this next couple of years to help keep people involved and educated?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's two angles. I mean, one, you know, we obviously have to be on the defense. We have to defend whatever, you know, the laws and protections we have now, in Congress. And I'm not sure how that's all going to work yet, given the layout of Congress now. But that, you know, we have to do that. But at the same time, we should be on the offensive. And let me just go back to what you mentioned before, heat. Now, the federal heat standard is probably dead or at least dormant for the next several years. But there's no reason, you know, there's a bunch of OSHA state plan states that control their own occupational safety and health programs. And several that are run by Democrats. There's no reason they shouldn't be able to pass heat standards in those states. I mean, Arizona, New Mexico, just for example, Hawaii, you know, and some of these states that have major heat problems. And there's no reason, you know, more cities can't pass ordinances for heat too. Once we get enough of these, passed, and we've seen this pattern before, you know, it's possible that the federal government or even the corporate honchos will say, listen, we cannot deal with 10 or 25 or 50 different heat regulations around the country. We need a federal standard. So, I mean, the more you have local activity going on, the more it kind of forces up, you know, into change at the top. So at the same time, I think we're defending what we have now. I think we also have to go on the offensive and really push things out in the local state and eventually federal level as well. And let's not forget, you know, we have midterm elections around the corner. I know it's hard to believe, but in just 2 years. So there's no reason not to, use this stuff to start organizing for that as well.
I believe this is going to be a very dangerous next year, and there will be a lot of fodder for the election in 2 years to right some of the ship. And look, on the heat standard front, the fact that Trump appointed this Chris Wright, Secretary of Energy, founder and CEO of a big energy company out in Colorado, a climate denier. I can't imagine it's going to get any better.
Yeah.
Jordan, I appreciate the time. As always, good stuff.
All right. Thanks, Rick.
Our good friend, Jordan Barab. Make sure you check out his website, jordanbarab.com/confined space. We'll get links out on social media. I want to hear your thoughts. Any concerns, fears, maybe a hope? I want to even hear from the CEOs. Tell me what your dreams are. What's on the wet dream list? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1888. That was the day that William LeGrand Bundy is credited with inventing something that has become a daily part of life for millions of workers. His time recorder was a time clock that could record when workers arrived and left their jobs each day. The clock would record the time on a paper tape when a worker inserted his or her individualized numbered key. Bundy was a jeweler and an inventor from New York. After inventing his time clock, he went into business with his brother Harlow and founded the Bundy Manufacturing Company. With the growth of factories, there was more and more demand for time clocks. They were considered more exact and efficient than human timekeeping. Keeping track of hours worked and labor costs became an essential part of squeezing every drop of profit out of the industrial workforce. The Bundy brothers located their company in the city of Binghamton in southern New York. Business thrived. Other inventors put their own twist on the time clock. At the turn of the 20th century, the Bundy Company merged with several other timekeeping outfits, forming the International Time Recorder Company. Workers across the United States, Canada, and Europe had their work hours recorded by international time clocks. Later, the company became part of International Business Machines, or IBM, one of the worldwide leaders in workplace technologies. Over the years, new innovations have been introduced to employee timekeeping, such as time cards and computer-linked swipe cards. Working 9 to 5, what a way to make a living, barely getting by. It's all taking and no giving. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I was going to say, I really like Jordan Barrett, and you know, we've had Jordan on the show for years to talk about just how important OSHA is. It's one of those little agencies, those little things that government does that makes lives better. And understand, with the right wing, what the corporate interests want us to believe, job-killing regulations, this is one of those things where without this, we're talking people killing lack of regulations. And I think, and we brought it up with Jordan there a second ago, I don't think there's anyone really working today that remembers how bad things were pre-OSHA. You know, 1970 was a long time ago. Kind of is. So you look at the reality of going, most people who were in the workforce in that era of no OSHA, they're long retired, and unfortunately for many, long gone. So I think we forget just how hazardous many industries were, how many people were dying on the job every year more than there are now, how poorly regulated industry was at the time, and how by not having a federal standard, you had this massively inconsistent enforcement across states. So you had a race to the bottom in states where they're like, well, we can't possibly regulate, you know, this because we'll lose the industry. They'll go mostly to the South, which has always been interesting to me in that, you know, you go, they're going down South, and you would think the Southern workers would go, you know, you're coming here because you can exploit us more. And the answer is yes. But understand, pre-OSHA, the injury rates and the fatality rates were considerably higher, especially when you look at manufacturing, construction, mining, all of these industries that we want to come back, they want to bring back in, well, pre-OSHA environment so we can, you know, get the most desperate to come work. Now, you go back to, you know, the pre-OSHA, pre-labor law. You know, you worked sun up to sun down, 6 days a week, sometimes seven, and still didn't make ends meet. No overtime, no, none of that, no weekends. And for wages that did not support a living. And understand, you know, poor health conditions. You know, right now, one of the big things that we talk about quite often is, you know, exposure to all kinds of chemicals and toxic substances, asbestos, lead, you know, hazardous materials that are being used all over the place. Back then, it was commonplace for people to deal with carcinogens and toxic chemicals without even gloves or any type of, even the appearance of a dust mask or any health monitoring or any accountability for the company doing it. It basically was, sorry, buddy, you're on your own. we were in an environment of, you know, child labor in all kinds of conditions. And I know that's a separate thing, but it's part of this as well. When workers lack rights in the workplace, it leads to unsafe conditions. It leads to exploitation. It leads to a race to the bottom. And in that environment, had you raised your hand and said, hey, this isn't right, they just sent you packing. And that's where the corporate class wants us to return to. You know, we've talked quite often about the Lochner era. How if you were desperate enough and poor enough to work for poverty wages and deplorable conditions and dangerous conditions, that's your liberty, it's your right, it's your freedom. They want to bring that back. And they're quite open and honest about it. I've been saying this for almost 20 years now. They've been moving us in this direction slowly, like the frog in the boiling water, to where now they believe they've got us primed, prepped, and ready to be exploited. And the thing is without OSHA, and again, this is a very small organization, but has a big impact in just the hope that employers will play by the rules. You know, when workers have that ability to say, you know, I'm not going to do this, and we're gonna go to OSHA to make sure that this is a safe workplace, that means something. When you gut it and you take it away, when no one fears it, what then happens? It's kind of like a highway that you know there are no policemen on. Do people follow the speed limit? Of course they don't. And corporate America is no different. If you don't have regulatory enforcement, you don't have enough people to conduct inspections, you don't have enough people to conduct investigations, when bad stuff happens, guess what? More bad stuff's going to happen. If you don't do the training and the education process that a lot of OSHA policy mandates, bad things happen. OSHA also collects data. They do research into injury rates, into illnesses, and ways to help working people, not the CEOs. They don't care about you or me. And we're going to find that out in a huge way over the next year, two, four, as our CEO government implements the things that they've always wanted to do. They don't want to pay taxes. They don't want to follow any rules. They don't want to be responsible for anything that they do. They just want profit, more and more profit. And we're going to see what cold-hearted, captain of industry, corporate CEO kind of capitalism looks like. That means you're disposable. Understand, if we allow them to eliminate or neuter or destroy OSHA, you will see workplace injuries and fatalities increase. You will see a lack of accountability. And again, without the regulatory body to enforce and to investigate when bad things happen, there will be a culture of negligence that happens, and employers will stop giving a you-know-what about anyone. And there will be an economic impact. But do you think it's going to be the corporations who are going to bear the brunt of the costs? Of course not. You take your injury and all your problems and your bankruptcy with you. We'll just get someone else to fill your void. We can go down the list on all the things that are bad about deregulation. Now, am I saying all regulations are wonderful? No, we can tweak some. There are things that, you know, we can do better, and I'm all in favor of that. But this idea of going in with an axe, going in with a chainsaw where you need a scalpel, this idea of a sledgehammer where maybe you could just push something with your thumb, we're going to see pain and misery. But also, I come back to this frame. You know, again, which side are you on? The CEO side, which is, hey, we need to deregulate, cut to the bone, create desperate and dangerous conditions so that we can profit more? Or are you on the side of, hey, wait a second, before we go doing that, who are we talking about? Who are the ones that are going to be the ones suffering in this? And I think once you start asking your question, especially on this issue, which side? You quickly realize that we as working people, no matter how divided you think this country is, We're united on the other side of what this administration is going to be moving on. I believe that wholeheartedly, but I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Anything I've said got on your nerves, under your skin, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, podcast. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@thericksmithshow.com.
This is 540 WAUK Jackson, Milwaukee's real news and great conversation. A Civic Media station.